Welcome to another Leon Chani Report, and I'm sure you're all bummed out by all the inauguration pictures by 2 million people on the Lincoln Plaza, by the fact that his wife had a gown on by some who knows what, but that the fellow, or who is or the designer is, will become a millionaire. Obama looks strong and tough, and he's a basketball player, so we all love that. And now he's got to go to work. One of the things we'll talk about later on the show, Oriel Hyman will be here from JTA, which is the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, is the fact that George Mishal was appointed as the Middle East negotiator or ambassador or player or whatever you want to call it. We'll go into depth about that because I know a lot of people are very anxious about Obama, Israel, and Hillary Clinton. But before we get to that, we have to talk about economics. And we have Simon Constable on here, who's with Dow Jones. And he, of all things, by the way, in his prior life, worked for General Motors. And I'd like to talk to him about what he thinks the automobile industry should get from the government or should not get from the government. You're not related to them. Any, you have any stock in General Motors?
Absolutely not.
You're emphatic about that.
Absolutely not.
So should the United States bail them out?
I don't think so. What was amazing to me is before the holidays, GM said, we want some money from the government. They got some. And then
got a bridge loan.
They got a bridge loan. And then immediately in the new year, one of the big guys there, Fritz Henderson, says, I think we might need some more, which is what a number of us have been saying all along, is don't give these guys any money because basically you might as well burn it because you ain't going to see it again. What I've always thought with General Motors is it needed to go through some sort of reorganization, like a Chapter 11 reorganization, and that's where you go before a bankruptcy judge and you get some of your debts and some of your contracts renegotiated. So the bondholders take it on the chin a bit, and maybe some of the union contracts will be reduced a little bit, and you know, that's a sort of reorganization that you do.
Well, why don't they do it?
Well, they should. First of all, they should have done that, and
but
one
they
of the
didn't. That's
they
passed.
Didn't. And one of the things that the management over there, Rick Wagner and the crew, were saying was, look, no one will buy cars from a quote-unquote bankrupt company. Now, although Chapter 11 is technically part of the bankruptcy code...
It's a reorganization.
It's a reorganization. Right. And they were spinning that amazingly as, we don't want to go through this. And I think it's because they didn't want to be in front of a bankruptcy judge who might actually start to talk sense rather than Washington, D.C., where you've got politicians who, you know, may believe the kind of smoke that's being blown their way.
All right. Will they be saved by the government or not?
I don't think they deserve to be.
But do you think they will be?
No, I don't think so. I think we end up in the same place as we would have done, minus our money, your money and my money.
The bridge loan won't get repaid?
I think it's a type of loan you get from your parents that thanks, I'll pay you back, as if. You know, and it never happened.
Well, okay, Obama's riding in a Cadillac. Will he be able to service that in 2 years through General Motors?
Well, I think what ideally will happen with General Motors is that it gets the component parts of it get snapped up by maybe foreign manufacturers that are domestic to the U.S., if you like Toyota and Honda and Nissan. They manufacture here with American workers.
So they're going to sell the brand?
Yeah, that's what I would suggest that they do. There's nothing wrong with the workers, and there's basically not massive amounts wrong with the cars that can't be fixed in a big way. So the Cadillac, yes, of course it'll be able to be repaired, you know.
Cadillac, I've said this 10 times already, that China has more Cadillacs than any other car. It's the prestige car in China. So they do well around the world, General Motors, but not too well in the United States. But the peripheral or the effect of a General Motors going out of business or changing its modus vivendi or operandi means that a lot of people will lose jobs. A lot of people who have homes will lose their homes. I mean, you have a spiraling effect here. A lot of parts people will lose theirs.
Well, the way Rick Wagner and the team at General Motors and also some of the other auto execs and leadership have been really playing that up massively, they've been sort of making out like it's going to be a complete liquidation and that basically you're turning the lights out on the Midwest if you go through a reorganization. I don't believe that will happen. I believe that, yes, some people will lose their jobs. Certainly management needs to lose their jobs. And that may be
across... Management's nothing.
It may be 20,000, 30,000 people throughout Detroit and the upper Midwest. there may be some union workers that lose their jobs, but the vast majority could save their jobs if these companies were being run by people who knew what they were doing. And maybe that's Honda, and maybe that's Toyota.
So, Simon, are you the only guy on earth that knows this?
I think a lot of people know this. I think a lot of politics is being talked, and obviously we've had an election, and politics is, you know, that's the time to talk politics.
Obama's a Democrat. He came in with help of union help. There's no question about it.
No question.
And Democrats stand for unionization. Will he be able to allow something like the United States car industry to go into a reorganization or a total, maybe a half collapse?
Well, I hope he will, but it needs to be sold correctly and appropriately to the American people. And
you think Tim Geithner can do it if he can't pay his taxes?
They need to get someone to communicate this. We have a very good U.S. auto industry, the cars being made by Toyota in the U.S., by Honda, in the U.S., by American workers doing a great job. That is the U.S. car industry. Britain, until the recent downturn, Britain had more car workers than it had ever had, and all of it's foreign-owned.
All right.
Making things like Mini Coopers and stuff like that.
Let's talk about the economy. That's what you write about. You're a columnist for Dow Jones, which is the premier organization on economy in the world, probably. Maybe Forbes and Fortune will fight you, but let's assume
I've heard of them.
Let's assume that for tonight. Anyway, Tim Geithner, he messed up on his taxes.
Yeah.
Is that infallible?
You know, messing up on your taxes, a lot of people do it.
But they're not Treasury Secretaries.
They're not Treasury Secretaries. That is true.
Running the IRS.
They're not running.
Treasury Secretary runs the IRS.
But he wasn't previously running the IRS. I think that actually points to one thing, that maybe the tax code needs to be simplified, and that would be a good thing. I would point to that. You know, he seems
that has
like,
no relationship to him not paying his tax, though. That has to do with his credibility as a person.
I understand.
I'm not critical. I'm asking what you think, because you write about this all day. Is he going to get confirmed, by the way?
I think he's going to get confirmed. I mean, some people are saying he's in trouble, but it seems to be moving forward. I think he's obviously got a ton of experience, you know, running the New York Fed. And
the most experienced guy in finance was Meyer Lansky. You remember Meyer Lansky?
I've heard of him.
They say he was the genius of finance. So the fact that he's great at something doesn't mean that he obeyed. I don't want to criticize him. I'm just curious how you people and who write.
He
about
seems to be being well received on Wall Street, you know, and across Wall Street. That's all I'll say to that. And you know, obviously, whoever is in that role has to be accepted by Wall Street as well as by Congress and as well as by, you know, the general public.
All right, unemployment. Do you see that rising?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's going up.
Where do you think it's going to wind up?
Definitely in double digits.
So do I.
Yeah,
I said that to Forbes magazine.
Yeah, definitely.
Where do you think oil will be in 6 months?
That's a tough one. You know, obviously it's quite low now. It's well below $40 a barrel. Certainly it was the last time I looked. You know, it could languish for a long while. At some point, so when the economy recovers, it will go back up. I just don't see it going much higher this year.
Carolyn Cassan is coming on. She's an expert on oil. She and I were debating this in the elevator. I think oil's dropping to $30. She thinks by the end of the year it's coming up, but she'll come on later and rationalize her position. I think it's going down.
It certainly could go up if the dollar weakens and there is a chance that the dollar collapses, but we'll see.
Would you buy gold today?
I think gold is a very good buy today. I think gold is a superb buy for the medium term. The amount of money being created in the system, staggering.
We're going to have to devalue the dollar, you think, because of all this debt that we're putting on?
At some point, that money will start moving around. I mean, they say inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods. Now, right now, we have tons of money out there, if you have quote-unquote money, but it's not doing any chasing because it's just sitting in banks, not going anywhere. When it starts moving, gold will be bid up massively.
Would you be buying bank stocks tonight? A lot of people are, by the way.
Yeah, I've heard that, yeah.
I'll tell you the reasoning. Basically, if you want to have a recovery of the financial, of the economics in the country, you need a financial system.
Yep.
Now, the thing that I'm not clear about, and maybe you can answer, when people talk about nationalizing the banks, what does that exactly mean?
That's when the government owns.
No, that I understand. But what happens to the shareholders?
Well, the shareholders, largely get wiped out. It depends how you, exactly how you do it.
So if you nationalize Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, every shareholder in the United States would be wiped out.
Well, it depends on the exact terms of it, and you'd have to look on the under the exact terms of the nationalization of each thing. I'm sorry to evade the question, but it's like...
No, you're not. I'll give the answer.
Okay.
They'll get preferred stock.
Which is a form of debt, let's be honest.
And equity holders will hold on, and they'll get a penny dividend like Bank of America and Citibank. You can't wipe out the common equity of all these banks. There are too many people invested in them.
Yeah, there are, but a lot of these banks are actually really worth nothing. So,
they're all insolvent tonight,
yeah.
That's for sure. But they need to raise capital. In order to raise capital, you're not going to be able to have a nationalized bank. No one will invest in it. You won't be seeing a dividend. People invest so they get a return. It's very complicated, this stuff. I happen to know a little bit about it because I work in finance a lot, and I understand much of it more than most people do, and people are nervous about they hear nationalized banks. They think all their equity is going to be wiped out. And people on pensions and hedge funds and who didn't invest with Madoff are just regular people, you know, and they're really worried because, you know, you have Citibank at $3, Bank of America at $5, a very good bank, M&T Bank, dropped from 90 to 35, and they're profitable. So that means there's a crisis in confidence.
There's
no realization of what's going on, no reality. So my question to you, because you work for Dow Jones, is when is this consumer confidence going to come back, or confidence in the financial system going to come back?
Well, I would certainly be a lot more confident if I saw less government meddling.
Really?
The auto industry is a great example of that. But the more government meddling we get, it just slows things down.
Explain to my audience, I'm sniffling. It's not that I'm crying over Obama's swearing in. I was moved by it, but I'm just sniffling. So
one of the things that we have when the government starts deciding to rescue some institutions and not others is that creates uncertainty for investors. And investors don't like that uncertainty.
That's a good point.
And so they're going to stay on the sidelines until they know that the government is done. Now, the past government, and I think this government, we'll have to wait and see, the past government was good on meddling in this financial crisis and saying, I'm going to let Lehman Brothers fail, but not their Stearns. And, you know, it's kind of that uncertainty
is created.
You're saying
something more. You're saying something Talmudic, by the way. You're not even aware of it.
Apparently not.
No. What happened was that your great friend, Henry Paulson, who you interview all the time, came out with one idea and then reversed course in about 3 months, 2 months, half a month, I don't know, later.
Flip-flop.
And exactly what you're saying, he broke the confidence of the United States financial markets in one shot. Very few people will say that, and I will say it because I'm not indebted to anybody except all the banks maybe, but who cares? But this is really what broke the confidence, and what you're saying is absolutely true, and no one talks about it. Yeah. There is no stability in the system so that people will feel confident to come back and invest.
And that's what we need. Yeah, we need some certainty.
I agree with you. And that was broken. He did two bad things. He may be a nice man and he goes to church on Sunday. He's probably a good Episcopalian. And I heard that he's a good guy. But he waffled on his positioning, which you can never do when you're in leadership. And he let Lehman go down. He should never have let Lehman go down, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, there's been a lot of speculation about why that was.
Well, they said he had a rift with him. There were better words to use than that.
The rift. I like that.
You like that word, rift?
Yeah, we were joking that maybe Dick Fuld beat Paulson at tennis 5 years ago or something, and that's why. I don't know the truth of that, but it's funny.
They're probably playing bridge with, what's his name, Jimmy Kane from Bear Stearns?
Yes.
I was at a luncheon the other day and sat next to John Thayne, and now he's being criticized because he didn't disclose the books of Merrill Lynch. Well, shouldn't the Bank of America people have done some due diligence and examined their books?
Undoubtedly, you know, due diligence is always good to do. It's very easy to look back in hindsight at these things. The due diligence time you typically get for a takeover isn't very long.
He bought that very quickly. I know Ken Lewis. He really wanted to expand. He bought Country Bank and Merrill Lynch. Something which is funny, or maybe absurd. Dick Parsons was just made chairman of the bank of Citibank, right? Mm. He was on the board at all time. I'm not critical of Parsons. He's a nice guy. He was, I think, my seatmate on a flight that I made the other day. Nice man. But would you promote someone who's seen the demise and been on that board? I mean, Rubin, Parsons, they were all part of this board that let Citibank go and really enormous damage to people all over the world. Not so worried about Prince Alid, you know, he lost $3 billion. But a lot of, you know, widows and orphans had a lot of money there.
No, that isn't funny. When widows and orphans are living, it's very bad.
I'm serious. I mean, people are hit all over the place.
But this isn't a new story, that the fact that, you know, people in positions of power and influence fall upwards. They don't tend to cascade down. That is a story as old as this country, and going back to other countries, it's just the way it is.
Right, but you're talking about a half-nationalized bank in Citibank. Yeah. The government really owns the bank, right? Mm. And it still goes on. I mean, they should, you know, sweep it clean, put on a new board there, and maybe get some new energy, a new direction in it.
And, you know, it's funny, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about Citigroup and saying the Citigroup we have known and come to love, sort of it's gone. It's going to be, you know, a very different institution.
It never made any sense for Smith Barney to be with Citigroup. There was never a synthesis there. It never worked. It never worked well. And you can't start these financial capitals. Years ago, I was on a thing called the Wynn Commission, which Mario Cuomo put together to combine financial services, banking and securities. The Glass-Steagall Act, you know, when banks couldn't get into selling stocks, which was a pretty good thing. All of a sudden that broke down. You had financial services. Everybody wanted to be king of the road. And so they all merged, and look what happened. It's a collapse of the whole system.
We're going to be going back to a boutique system. You're going to go to different storefronts for your different services that you need.
I agree with you. I said that today. Yeah. I said exactly that. People need banking, and they need things to happen. And the same thing with, investment banking. You'll have a lot of boutique guys who are trying to do it. No more big bonuses, though, huh?
Well, bankers are clever at finding ways to make money, and that's one thing they're very good. They will find a new way to make money. What's one of the great things about Goldman Sachs historically is that the bank internally has always changed a lot, and they used the same brand name, Goldman Sachs, and they would, you know, increase those areas that were doing well and decrease those areas that weren't doing so well, and that's that sort of the drive to get profit. That drive to make money isn't going to go away. It's fundamental to banking.
It's capitalism.
And it's also fundamental to American entrepreneurs, a sort of very vigorous group of people who will go after making money. And I think that's the good news, is there are a lot of people out there like that who will come in. I'm just hoping that the government doesn't sort of crowd out everything, and that's an economics term, but basically just get in too much of the economy so that the opportunities for entrepreneurs to come in and make something, it's going to be harder.
How's the Wall Street Journal doing? That's one of your babies, right? Dow Jones.
Wall Street Journal's doing great. Obviously, I think it's doing better than the New York Times. I think they're having some issues now, but I probably shouldn't comment on that. But
they had a Mexican guy put in $250 million the other day, right? The New York Times.
Yep.
Wow. Anyway, good to see you, Simon. You gave us some insights. I happen to agree with you. Economy is really what's going on in the world today, and everybody is hit by it. You go to England, RBS, which is Royal Bank of Scotland, is now owned by the Queen. She's took over. You go to China, Hong Kong, everything's falling down. Everything, real estate's going down. So who knows when it all recovers, but we'll try to dig it out and bring it to you. So we'll bring on Uriel Hyman now, who's the publisher, editor of JTA, Jewish Telegraph Agency, and we're going to talk about Obama in the Middle East, see what he's going to do over there. Everybody is really anxious, I won't say nervous, but anxious about what Obama's policy will be. George Bush was freewheeling with Israel. He backed them nearly 100%, and he let them do exactly what they thought they wanted to do. We'll ask Uriel if he thinks that's going to happen in the future. And then we'll bring on Carolyn Casson, and she'll fight with me about the price of oil. And by that time, oil will probably collapse within the hour. Hong Kong will come out with some news. We'll be right back.
What's wrong with this picture? Half of young Americans can't locate economic powers like Japan and India. 20% can't even find the Pacific Ocean. Without geography, our children aren't ready for the world. Geography is everywhere. It's incredible creatures. Rhythm. Fashion. Flavor. It's economics and politics. It's change. Understanding connections between people and places is critical in the 21st century. That's why we created mywonderfulworld.org. Go there now for your free parent and teacher action kits and give our kids the power of global knowledge. Because kids who understand our world today can succeed in it tomorrow.
Careful. Well, that's a nice picture.
Come on, Anna.
Okay. Foreclosure doesn't affect just you. It affects your whole family, too. If you've fallen behind on your mortgage, we can help. Call 1-888-995-HOPE, because nothing is worse than doing nothing.
You've known for years that this is the number one cause of lung cancer, smoking. That's why the Surgeon General issued this warning. But do you know the number one cause of lung cancer for non-smokers? It's in this room. You can't see it or smell it. It's radon. Radon is an invisible radioactive gas that seeps inside your home from underground. It can build up to dangerous levels without notice. Now the Surgeon General has issued another lung cancer warning. And whether you smoke or not, breathing radon can cause lung cancer. That's why you need to have your home tested. Protect your family. Call 1-800-SOS-RADON. Heed the warning. Have your home tested, because radon problems can be fixed.
Read. Visit literacy.gov and let the journey begin.
We're back. I'm Leon Chani. We're talking to Uriel Hyman, who is the editor or publisher of Jewish Telegraphic Agency, which I remind people is like the Associated Press in the Jewish world. They do stories about the Israeli and Israel and the Jewish world. And it's a wire service, I guess. Is there still wire services anymore? Or are there internet services?
We use the internet now.
All right, let's talk seriously. George Mitchell was appointed today or as the Middle East representative or special envoy, whatever you want to call him. What are your feelings about that?
Well, you know, I think this is a very quick and clear sign that the Obama administration is going to take a different approach to Middle East peacemaking than the Bush administration. Bush was perceived as being really behind Israel in Israel's corner and unwilling to engage in the hard work of Middle East peacemaking. Obama has made clear both during the campaign and even in the 2 days that he's been president that he will be an engaged president. We have a Secretary of State who is making Middle East a top priority and is very familiar with that area, and certainly the appointment of Mitchell as a special envoy to the Middle East just ratchets that up further.
He has a Lebanese background, Mitchell. He has a Lebanese background. He's been to the Middle East as a negotiator once before, and his claim to fame is the fact that he did something in Ireland. He tried to negotiate this whole deal in Ireland, and he's a former federal judge. He's an intelligent guy, but you're right. People have to get used to a different understanding and balance.
And the difference between Northern Ireland and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict at this moment in history is that the Northern Ireland conflict was moving toward a resolution at the time when Mitchell stepped in, and he brought the parties, closed that final gap. The Israelis and Palestinians, even though everybody says that we know what the final agreement will look like, a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, some division of Jerusalem, and a final peace deal with Israel, in the last few years, the ability of those two parties to make peace has decreased. And the Gaza war was another step down and I think farther away from the table. And Israel's upcoming election next month, February 10th, may be another step away as Benjamin Netanyahu, who's leading the polls, appears to be the front runner.
All right. Let's talk about the Gaza war. Did Israel gain anything? Was there a victory there? Ehud Barak claimed it's a great victory.
I think there was a victory for Israel in this war. Remember, Israel fought a very similar war 2 years ago in southern Lebanon against Hezbollah. And Israel was really battling the ghosts of Hezbollah in Gaza against Hamas. And I think that what this war demonstrated for Hamas, first of all, it was much more successful militarily than
it was very
the war
good
was
strategy.
In southern Lebanon.
Strategically, it was done well.
Hamas basically saw they could not defeat the Israeli forces, and in most cases,
they
simply chose
hiding.
Not to fight.
Right.
They chose not to fight. But Israel was successful both in crippling a lot of their military infrastructure, not eliminating their ability to fire rockets. I don't think that's possible. But certainly sending a message to Hamas and really disincentivizing them from making trouble for Israel again. And indeed, we've seen a decrease in
rocket fire
sales.
If that's true, then it's a great victory. I said by telephone, I was out of the studio, that one of the important things of the Gaza war was the fact that Egypt got very involved and that Egypt made a decision that was much more important to get along in a cold way with Israel than to have itself associated strongly with Iran, because they knew that Iran was funding the Hamas, and the Hamas were in brotherhood with the brotherhood, the fanatical brotherhood in Egypt, which is against Mubarak. And Mubarak is no fool, and he understood it very well, and he became very involved. The real question is whether Egypt will really prevail in stopping all this illegal armament through the tunnels. That's the real question today.
Right, well, there's two questions for Egypt. Number one, do they want to stop all the trade through the tunnels? It's
My
not
guess
just
is
armament trade, but there's also a lot of economic trade.
Right. My guess is Mubarak, personally, would like to do it, but I don't think he can control everything that goes on. It's a whole black market, by the way.
It's a whole black market. It supports the economy of the Egyptian side of Rafah. But more than that, Egypt is somewhat handicapped in its ability to implement military control over that area. According to Egypt's peace deal with Israel, it's very specific about what kind of military ordnance and material and personnel they're allowed to have stationed in the Sinai Peninsula. And Israel has not been flexible in changing that. And Egypt may at some point come to Israel and say, look, we can't stop the smuggling with these limitations. And that may be a red line for the Israelis, because remember, the point of that, when Israel signed the peace deal with U.S. backing in 1981 and effected the pullout after the Camp David Accords, was essentially to make sure that Egypt would not have the capability to surprise Israel with an attack.
This was called the Gaza liaison. I happen to work on it. So you're talking to somebody who knows a little bit about it.
So you should tell the audience, Robert.
I don't like to steal the show. I like to bring you on and let you talk. But all in all, if you put it on a scale of 1 to 10, Egypt is a 7 today. It's a positive for Israel. And I think there's a united front between Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia in saying, look, we don't really like what's going on in Iran, and we should stick around with Israel.
That's exactly right. There really is a split in the Arab world. It's no longer the Arabs against the Israelis or the Jews, but the split is between the moderates and the extremists. And the split runs right in between the middle of the Palestinian polity, with the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas on one side, and Hamas and the Gaza Strip and the fundamentalist Palestinians on the other side. And the question is, who will win? You know, you mentioned Egypt. I'll mention something that you can't talk about in Egypt, which is, you know, Mubarak, he looks good, he looks young, he dyes his hair. He's in his mid-70s.
He has no successor.
And he's had some health problems. He has no clear successor.
Right.
And there's a strong opposition in Egypt. We've seen Islamic revolutions in the last few, a generation ago in Iran. We see Lebanon moving more toward Islamism. The Palestinians have had much more
Islamism. Fundamentalism is very strong.
What happens when Mubarak dies and the strong opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood, tries to exert its influence? It's a real question.
Could be chaotic. They're trying to groom his son to take the lead there, but I'm not sure it can work. I talked to Nabil Osman, who's now the press spokesman for Mubarak, and he says that Egypt is a democracy. If Egypt is a democracy, you're a pope. But they have some kind of assembly, and they get together once in a while, you know, and it looks like somebody votes. It's usually 99% one way or another. I had a far-fetched theory that Saudi Arabia secretly was trying to support Israel by dropping the price of oil so that Iran would not be able to profit by making, because when oil goes down, Tehran loses a lot of income. And basically the Saudis control the market in oil. You know, you can look to Caracas and Venezuela, but in the end of the day, and you don't know what's going on, because if oil was collapsing, Iran's budgets were going the other way. It's an interesting concept. I don't know.
I don't know if I see that. I don't think that I agree with you on the notion that Saudi Arabia controls the price of oil. Aside from the fact that they may have the plurality, but they don't have the majority of the world's oil.
They have a great influence.
They do have a great influence, but you know, we see on every other level how difficult it is for the Arab countries to get their act together, to coordinate. We just saw it in the conference.
It's not only
in
the
Qatar.
Arabs. Putin is dying. You know, I don't know how much you know about Russia, but they devalued the ruble twice this week. You know what that means? It means revolution over there. They like revolution. Sells a lot of books, you know, in Russia.
We're still waiting for the revolution in Venezuela.
Venezuela, it's not as strong as... It's indigenous to the character of the Russian people. Putin knows this very well. And so I always connect oil with revolutions. And Carolyn will come on later. We'll discuss that. But let's go back to Israel. Bibi is tonight. How many seats would he get? About 40?
No, he's not quite at 40.
35?
He's more in the 30s.
Barack went up since the war?
Barack went up during the war, and he's come back down a little bit since then. Labor is now up to 15, which is better than they were a month ago, but historically it's really disastrous.
But the deal everybody thinks in Israel, I've heard it too, is that Bibi and Barack will make a deal, and Barack will stay as defense minister.
That's quite likely, and Barack may be a good defense minister.
He is a good
defense. Interesting, you know, everybody wants to be a prime minister in Israel, but sometimes they're much better suited to a different task. I think Barak makes an excellent defense minister. I think Netanyahu makes an excellent finance minister. And who knows, maybe Livni does make an excellent foreign minister. Livni, for me, is really an enigma. She's a mystery.
Yeah.
You know,
I think she lost.
People project onto her the qualities they like, and her opponents project onto her the qualities they don't like. And Livni's sort of navigated the choppy water of Israeli politics, but she hasn't really made her mark. People don't really know what she stands for. They call her Mrs. Clean because she hasn't been tainted by corruption scandals. But what do we really know about Livni?
She didn't look good during the war, and her appearances during the war looked like she didn't have control. She didn't know where she was or how to respond.
She's also uncomfortable in English, which is important to note.
I understand, and that's very important, especially when you're talking to the foreign press.
Sure.
Because the perception is that you don't know where you are. We know Tippi, we've had her on the show. I know her father was a staunch Republican, let's call him. He was an Irgunist, really, first order. But the question in Israel is, would they not be better served now to have a national unity government?
Well, they might be better served. I don't know how much that would change the internal or the foreign policy of Israel. You know, the challenges that Israel faces, there's near unanimity of the three major parties at this point, Likud, Labor, and Kadima, particularly with regard to Iran and even with regard to the Palestinians. It will be interesting to see if after Netanyahu is elected, if after the election he drifts a little bit more toward the center.
He will. It's absolute. You can.
And it would be a shame to see Netanyahu, a Prime Minister Netanyahu, on the same collision course with the administration in Washington that he experienced when he was Prime Minister the first time.
He had a big fight with Clinton. I got a call from Clinton's people on a Friday evening. Netanyahu wanted to free Jonathan Pollard and bring him home on a plane. You remember that?
Well, not home. He never lived in Israel, but I remember that.
Well, he's a Jew. He has a right to return.
Sure.
And I told that to his people when I represented Jonathan Pollard, that one of the things he could do is give up his American citizenship and return to Israel. And someone had made a plan to make him a member of Knesset or something. Did you see that? And then he'd get diplomatic immunity. I mean, everybody's done things. Everybody thought
diplomatic immunity may be in Israel.
Well, it doesn't work. But right. Everybody thought Bush might pardon him, but he didn't.
I don't see a pardon coming for Jonathan Pollard. He may have gotten an unfair sentence, but at this point it's
why do you
it's
think that, by the way? For a full disclosure, I represented his situation for a couple of days. His Lebanese lawyer, Haibi, pleaded him guilty in 24 hours, and Haibi said to me on the telephone that, or his background was, that Zionism is racism. That's the lawyer that his father picked because of Father Hesburgh. People forget that history.
I just see it as untenable politically unless Israel were to make some sort of major concession or gesture in which the context of a Pollard clemency or a Pollard pardon would not appear as some sort of gift to the Israeli people or to the Jewish people or to the so-called Jewish lobby. Maybe if Israel were to sign some kind of peace deal and there were a concession in there, then it could be done. But if Bush didn't do it, who was arguably the most pro-Israel president in history, or at least uncritical of Israel,
right?
Then I don't see Obama doing it, and I don't see Obama's success for
him. No, it's too early for Obama, but you never know. You know, he could come out of left field with a hook shot. He's a big ball player. The question I have, I don't know if you know, Obama called Omar this week, right? You know what they spoke about?
Sure. Well, you know, it was one of these pro forma calls, but Obama expressed...
Was it recorded or was it real?
It was not recorded. And Obama expressed support for the ceasefire and a hope that Hamas would cease its rocket fire and pledged his assistance in helping tamp down the smuggling between Egypt and Gaza. You know, Olmert stepped into a diplomatic quagmire a few days ago when he boasted to an audience in Israel that he forced the United States to abstain in a vote in the Security Council during the Gaza War. The vote went 14-0, calling for a ceasefire. The United States abstained. Olmert claimed that the U.S. was going to vote for it. He called President Bush, interrupted a speech of the president's, and forced Condoleezza Rice to change the vote. The Americans said this is complete nonsense, and Olmert came out looking really bad.
What do you
bad.
Think?
I think that Olmert just invented it.
You really do?
I think
he, as the prime minister of a country, he could create a story like that?
I think he forgot for a moment where he was and making a speech and making this boast. And it's just, it's the kind of thing, it just, there's no reason for him to say it. If it were true, there would be even less of a reason for him to say it. This is a man, by the way, who most of Israel can't trust. He resigned amid multiple corruption
scandals. Yeah, but I heard
scandals.
They dropped most of the charges against Omar. Is that true?
Well, some of the charges haven't even been filed.
I believe.
He has not been
No, I heard, and these insiders are telling me that they have him on one issue, maybe, you know, credit cards or something like that, but everything else, there's not going to be an indictment. This is amazing.
It's impossible to know. He's a very bright guy. You know, whether or not he's clean is at this point beyond what
is, he dead politically? Nobody's dead in Israel.
In Israel, you can never say never. Look who's president, Shimon Peres, a man who was unable to win a single election.
Yitzhak Rabin, I sat in his living room when he resigned as prime minister. I represented him, basically his wife. She had a bank account that was not correctly put together, let's say. And I said to him that night, he had just resigned. I was sitting on Rav Ashi Street. That's where he lived. I said, you know, Yitzhak, you'll make a comeback. He looked at me, he said, I'm not sure, I don't believe it. And he came back in glory, really in glory.
I'll tell you what I would like to see, incidentally. Like to see somebody who's not making a comeback. I'd like to see a fresh face. I'd like to see a Barack Obama in Israel. And I think a lot of Israelis would like that. And it's very...
Does he have to be born in Kenya?
Well, he could be born in Ethiopia right next door. But I think Israelis feel like they are stuck. You know, James Carville, when he ran Ehud Barak's campaign 9 years ago, he used the phrase takua, which means stuck in Hebrew. And Israel feels stuck. It's about to reelect somebody who's already been prime minister. The three major candidates for prime minister, two were prime minister already. One was prime minister designate and failed to put together a coalition. Israel needs
Livni was the new Obama, really. She was born in Israel, but it's a rough game in Israel. And if you talk to a lot of business people who do very well in Israel, they don't want to go near politics. And they're indicted every 4 hours. And Asa Weitzman, my good friend, told me that every prime minister in Israel went down without glory. You go to Sharet, Ben-Gurion, Levi Eshkol, everybody went down. There's something in the Israeli culture that collapses those people at the end. Olmert's going down without glory.
Well, Jews know how to be critics.
And Netanyahu's been examined by the police. Barak's been examined. Everybody's examined by the police. So, all right, we need to have a Jewish Obama. We'll see if we get a write-in. Maybe somebody's listening to us in Israel. We're televised over there. Maybe hearing us on your iPod. And if you have a great suggestion, write in, call us, and we'll get you a T-shirt, Leon Shani T-shirt. Oriel, always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Leon.
Who's going to win the election? Bibi?
Bibi.
All right. Maybe. We'll see. Carolyn Kassan is coming on. We're dripping with oil on this show, so she's going to tell us where oil is going. We'll be right back.
I present to you Algebra 2. Foreign languages. And finally, biology. Who among you will step up to their challenge?
Me.
Take on the tough classes now. You need them to prepare for college.
We're in an emergency situation. We don't have extra. We have a little bit of water and a little bit of food. A meeting place, no.
No.
I don't think we have a first aid kit.
We have tuna fish, we have beans, we have canned tomatoes,
true.
You know.
That's true, but that's really not survival food. Tomato paste.
Yeah, well, yeah.
No, what'd she say?
She said whatever.
No, she says that all the time.
What's that?
Hello? I'm on the phone.
Mom, I'm on the phone!
Hello? I'm on the phone.
Who's this? It's me. I'm on the phone. Mom?
Oh, you're on the phone. All right.
Sorry!
Sorry.
Sorry.
Anyway.
Who are you talking to? Kelly?
Mom.
All right.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to put up with you.
Any questions?
No.
You know.
We're not magicians. We can't read your mind.
We need your mind.
We need your questions, each and every kind. Will this react with my other medicine?
Hey, what are all these tests even for?
Big dreams and good grades aren't enough to get into college. There are actual steps you need to take. Finding someone who can help is the first and most important. For the next steps, go to knowhowtogo.org.
We're back. I'm Leon Charney. We're talking with Carolyn Casson. She is a doctor. She teaches at NYU Global Affairs, which is a pretty wide subject. What is global affairs, by the way, Carolyn?
Well, global affairs, the way that we think about it, it's, we have an energy and environment concentration, which is what I teach in. We also have humanitarian assistance and human rights, private sector concentration, as well as international relations and international law. So it's very much sort of is modeled after international relations, international affairs programs. But
That's a big bundle there. You got.
It's a lot, yes, but we have big ambitions.
All right. So, is the global world going to change because of Obama, Barack?
Well, I think the general sentiment right now is one that people generally hope. I think that Obama has been interesting with regards to sort of the international response. People are thrilled. Europeans are very happy. I was recently in Indonesia, and the Indonesians are very happy because Barack Obama actually spent some time, a short bit of time, living in Indonesia. So there's a connection that they feel to him. Africa, in terms of because of his Kenyan background. So I think he sort of touches a lot of different bases. So I think he has more of a global connection than Bush had.
And do you think that really means something in terms of America? What do you think that really means? Well, I believe, and I agree with you, but what does it mean, that the French will treat us better, or that if I go to Indonesia and I'll love Americans more?
Well, I think Sarkozy and Bush actually have had a generally strong relationship, and I think Sarkozy has been sort of friendlier towards the United States than sort of previous French
Sarkozy's
leaders.
No, Sarkozy is very friendly
yes,
to the United
States. Yes,
very friendly. States.
So I think
but
in
he
terms
was
of,
with Bush, too, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. With Bush, he very much was so. I think in terms of with Obama, I think Obama sort of speaks to a new beginning, a chance for the United States to sort of embark on a sort of a more positive public relations campaign of sorts, so that it's more one of cooperation, collaboration, rather than we will go alone, we will act alone, or we will only work in conjunction with those that are with us. I think Obama's message is one more of wanting to be sort of conciliatory in the sense that wanting to sort of open up communication with the world.
All right, let's break down what you do. I mean, global affairs. The first part was what? Humanitarian aid, you spoke about?
Well, that's one of our concentrations. I specifically teach global civil society, as well as a course on oil, as we were having.
We're going to talk about oil in a minute. What do you mean by global civil society? What does that mean?
Well, looking at civil society, looking at sort of organizations, non-governmental organizations,
NGOs,
social movements, groups of people that are sort of can speak out against their governments, participate with their governments. It's sort of
so
the third sector.
You support those people, or you study them?
Well, and with regards to my teaching, I teach about them. And in terms of I also have consulted for a number of different non-governmental organizations.
So give me an idea, let's say, in Indonesia.
For example, Save the Children. Right. You have an organization like Save the Children, right, which is very specifically focused on addressing the needs of children, and not just children, but generally its focus is on children. World Wildlife Fund, which, you know, has an environmental focus, so it's very much sort of advocating for protection of the environment, protection of coral reefs is one area.
You get into global warming?
Yes, of course. I mean, in terms of organizations, environmental organizations that focus on, that really are advocating to address climate change and address both at the advocacy level as also at the policy level. So
I'm trying to, I think I understand. You try to get into organizations or teach about them, various organizations that are not in the political system of these countries in order to improve their environment, improve their society, is that it?
Correct. Technically, non-governmental organizations are non-political, so they work outside
right.
of the official government sector,
right.
and they work outside of the private sector, so they are not-for-profit organizations.
How strong are these units around the world?
Very strong, very strong. I mean, it depends on what context, but I think in terms of environmental policy in the United States, I think environmental NGOs have been very, very powerful for pushing for change, for addressing consciousness, awareness around the environment. I think in terms of, you know, children's rights, human rights. Human Rights Watch, I think, is a very powerful organization worldwide. You know, there are a number of different governments that don't want to hear from Human Rights Watch, and they have a difficult time working in certain places. But nonetheless, I think that they do raise awareness about violations against...
All right. Do you do better with a Republican government in the United States or a Democratic government?
Would you mean, do I do better?
Do your causes do better? Do you get more sympathy from Republicans or Democrats?
Well, I think it really depends on the issue the issue that we're talking about. If it's, for example, George Bush really had a emphasis that he placed on faith-based organizations. So faith-based organizations did very, very well under the Bush administration. Whereas, you know, prior to Bush coming into office, faith-based organizations were not really targeted for funding by the U.S. government or by, you know, foundations. So I think that's been a shift. Obviously, money is an issue. So when we have a major downturn in the economy, such
right.
as what we have right now,
talk about that.
Nonprofit organizations have a difficult time raising funds because they look for donations from private citizens. They look for donations from foundations. You know, the banks have been major contributors to many different philanthropies around the world,
collapsed. I don't think they can do it now.
Well, I think it's going to be really, really challenging. I mean, you live here in New York City. Arts and cultural organizations, you know, museums, Lincoln Center. When you look at the list of sponsors at the end of a show, oftentimes you'll see the names of the big banks, and some of those big banks no longer exist.
You're saying something very important, and I'm not sure everybody understands it. Like, Citibank has a stadium with its name, you know, for who knows how much. There's going to be a revolution against that. People, stockholders will not put up with that.
And well, that's a whole other, I think that's another issue in terms of, and, you know, what's going to be interesting is to see with the commitments that they had made, what's going to happen. I mean, whether or not they're not going to be able to follow through with
My
them.
My guess is they'll have a struggle. Huh?
Correct, yes.
It's not going to be easy.
Correct. So nonprofit organizations are definitely feeling...
So that's what I'm bringing out now. But your area, which is endowed by a lot of private people, private donations and all, whether it's Humanitarian or Global Watch, the whole world is in a global depression, basically, or recession, whatever you want to say. And so what you have in areas that Carolyn works on, are you going to have people who get into bad habits and do bad things, and they're not going to be able to be controlled because they won't have their funding and who knows what. You know, you have a lot of people in societies that are helped by these people, and they won't be able to be helped. So
I definitely do think it's going to be
So that's another thing for Obama. I'm sure he's aware of it. He's a very humanitarian type of guy, a community advisor.
Sure, he has, you know, his background is in community organizing. I mean, he understands community types of organizations.
It's another byproduct of the collapse of the economies and organizations like CAROL, which are really worthwhile, you know, not only arts and culture, but civil rights, babies, everything. It's really tough.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about oil. You and I disagree. I think oil is going down, and you think by the
end
of
the... Just to clarify the conversation that we were having, I think it will actually go down further. But I do think when the economy starts to sort of swing upward, hopefully at the end of 2009,
happen?
Early 2010.
Why do you think it'll happen then?
I tend to like to be optimistic.
Is that a reason? No, but there has to be a fundamental reason. You think that Obama will be able to turn it around?
Well, I think that the stimulus program will in the short term do something. I think in the long, to be honest with you.
Okay,
I think,
what's bringing oil down now?
Well, obviously there's a large scale global recession. All you have to do is just look at the average American consumer. Even though the price of oil has fallen from a high of 147 in July to today was trading at $42 a barrel. Last week it was at $33 a barrel. People are paying less at the gas pump than they were in the summertime. However, many people are uncertain as to whether or not they're going to have jobs. So consumption has fallen off from where it was a year ago. And that's worldwide. So
you think when there's a turnaround, 2 years from now, let's say there's a turnaround, you think oil will be where?
It's really hard to say, so I'm not actually, I mean, I don't really feel like I'm in a position to...
A million people are waiting for your answer. You've got speculators willing to short and go long on you.
I can definitely see it at 80, you know,
really?
Back up to 80, yes. Well, because there are certain fundamental factors. I mean, once the U.S. economy starts to sort of go back up, hopefully sooner rather than later, then you're going to see consumption start to increase. But you also, one of the biggest issues I would say is that this is a cycle. So what happens when the price of oil falls, then investment into projects also.
Obviously, everything.
And right now there's a credit crunch, so many companies can't get access to credit.
All right, I'm going to bet against you, and I'm going to say 50.
50 when?
When 2 years from now.
Okay. How much?
What's the bet? 2 t-shirts from the Leon China Report and another cup. We'll see you next week. We ran out of time with Carolyn.